The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hi, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb, and it's just me today. Joe is away from work, so I reached out to Martin Wallen, professor emeritus at Oklahoma State University and author of numerous books, including the 2021 book Squid, part of the Reaction Animal series that we'll be discussing here today. The book is out in both digital and physical forms, and I highly recommend it as it dives into not only science and natural history, but also mythology, folklore, and literature. So without further ado, let's jump right into the interview and discuss all of this with Martin. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Your book, Squid, part of Reaction's Animal series, came out last year. And as I started reading it, I realized this was exactly the sort of book that we'd love to discuss on the show. So if I may cobble together a couple of questions here, where did your interest in cephalopods come from, and how did this book come together?
Right. Well, that's a nice question to begin with. I had written two other books about animals, one about foxes, which is also part of the Reaction Animal series, and I'd written a book about dogs. The book about dogs, I actually started before the fox book, and that really arose out of relationships I'd had with horses, oddly enough, but because I'd been around horses for a long time, I'd increasingly begun to wonder how to engage with or how to write about an animal with whom we have to engage in a completely nonverbal way, and most effectively through touch and other forms of sensory perception. And there's a mode of being on horses that's known as being quiet. But I could never quite work out a way to deal with that. So I began thinking more pointedly about my relationship with dogs and how we interact with dogs generally, which led me then to think about relationships with non-domestic animals like foxes and so on. And then I began to think, well, what about creatures that are even more alien to us, creatures we probably don't interact with on a daily level, the way we interact with domestic animals or even the wild animals that might be passing through our neighborhood. And I really began to question what animal might I explore, just in a perhaps a theoretical way, that would enable me to tackle questions like simply what is it like to be in a world with unknown, unknowable creatures, not only ones we have to remain quiet about, but ones we can barely even begin speaking about. And so I started exploring squids and found them enticingly bizarre and enticingly weird, and really just took up a series of questions about those strange, odd animals and how human cultures have over the millennia tried to describe them or account for them or express their anxieties about them and so on. And that's where I ended up.
Yeah, I really love the way that you tackle the subject of the animal, of the squid, in this book, because you approach it from the philosophical and the naturalist viewpoint. You get into the scientific research, both current and of the previous century and so forth. And then you get into this idea of literary treatment, mythological treatment, et cetera. So I love the net that you cast in this. But you begin with Aristotle and the 4th century BCE philosopher's attempts to understand and chronicle cephalopods. What did Aristotle get right and what did he get wrong?
Well, first of all, my approach to an ancient writer like Aristotle is that he's really working within his cultural context. So in his view, and in the view of, let's say, the classical Greek world, he got virtually everything right. What we would see that he got wrong in that regard is when he describes the cephalopods as bloodless, because of course they are not bloodless. They simply have a different color of blood than most of us terrestrial animals. And when he makes references to certain qualities, like the fact that they lay imperfect eggs, because we think, well, those are squid eggs and they're appropriate to squids and they're like squids, and that they're aqueous. But by imperfect, he means that's the term he uses in reference to other animals as well. By imperfect, he really means that the eggs keep the same appearance that they have when they're first laid by the mother squid. The way, let's say, chicken eggs or lizard eggs basically are laid as hard-shelled eggs and stay that way until they're hatched. So that seems like something incorrect in our thinking, but it's actually appropriate to Aristotle's conceptual view of the world. What we generally say that Aristotle got right, of course, is his physical descriptions of really all the animals and everything he writes about, and that's really what puts him at the very foundation of modern natural philosophy and ultimately modern science, because he does pay a lot of attention and great care to the physical appearance of squids, and that enables him to make certain rudimentary classifications among the different kinds of squids. It's also important to bear in mind, and maybe this is on the wrong side, but it's more of a qualification, that Aristotle being a Greek and a Greek of the 4th century BCE, really stayed pretty close to shore. Most of his observations of squids were done on the Isle of Lesbos in the Gulf of Kalani, rather than out in the deeper waters. So that means that the squids he saw were the smaller inshore varieties of squids, and possibly some of the larger varieties, which he probably would have seen on fishermen's boats or as dead specimens that floated ashore. And those would have been less common to him. And so he doesn't offer that many accounts of those squids, and nor does he really delve into the differences between the inshore and the offshore squids. So really, that's what I would say is, let's say, right and wrongish about Aristotle's accounts.
Now, you mentioned the fishermen, of course, and that leads to the question, like, what was the culinary view of squids and their relatives during Aristotle's time?
Well, that's an intriguing view. I think almost everyone who isn't a vegan has had calamari or maybe different kinds of squid. Squids are nice to eat. And they were nice to eat then, except that the ancient Greeks had a much more ambivalent view of what we call seafood than we do. And that ambivalence comes from a general revulsion toward the sea, which was commonly referred to as being simply perfidious, because it was a dangerous place. You could sink, you being a human, could sink down below the surface and never be seen again. And fish, including squids, were known to eat humans. And so the idea of eating an animal that eats humans just tends to stir the stomach, but also tends to rub against the philosophical view of metempsychosis, which would suggest that if squids are eating humans, then we are essentially eating humans that have been transformed into squids by their digestive tract. And that's something that seemed to be immoral and culpable. So that people who did eat squids, and there are numerous references to this ethical view, people who did eat squids were somehow morally suspect and somehow were either indulgent or not to be trusted. Part of that view, I think, gets exacerbated later on by the high morality of someone like Plato, who really lived a sort of puritanical or had a puritanical view of the world. And so he really condemned some of the writers who focused on their diets and what they enjoyed eating, like squids. So all in all, it was people ate them almost certainly, but they were unhappy about eating them, at least in the Greek world. And notably, there are very few visual depictions of squid or even marine life, apart from, let's say, dolphins, until pretty late in the Greek world.
Now, why is there so much terminological confusion concerning squids, octopuses, and cuttlefish in classical literature? This is something you discuss in the book.
Right. Well, again, that largely comes from Aristotle. Aristotle, when he was describing the cephalopods, really grouped them all under the general heading of malakoi, which can basically means soft-bodied creatures, or as I like to think, squishy creatures. And he didn't go into that much detail in distinguishing, as I said earlier, the inshore from the offshore squids. He distinguishes squids from cuttlefishes and octopuses, but even there he refers to the polypods, and then he'll refer to the cuttlefishes, sometimes using the term sepia, and other times as polypus, and other times as toothus, or other times still as toothos. And it, as later commentators and translators are obviously confused about exactly which creature he was referring to. The confusion has less to do with octopuses than it does with the two decapods, cuttlefishes and squids. And there, Aristotle does say that he does allow for a certain distinction, and that is based on the quality of their flesh. So cuttlefishes, which swim closer to shore, he says, absorb more of the hard surface, hard substances of the earth, so they have a bone running through their bodies, the cuttle bone, and that he referred to as the os sepii, or the sepia bone. And then the squids, he then just referred to as the toothus and the toothos. And it's hard really to know, again, what he meant by the toothus, which has the ending is, and toothos, which has the ending os, but it does seem that's largely my deduction, as based on lexicons and simply the fact that he gave more attention to the tooth is, that one tooth is refers to the inshore, tooth os refers to the offshore. So there's really a confusion of what the confusion is partly due to his vagueness in his accounts, and to the later confusion of commentators and translators, largely again because those commentators would themselves not have ventured out into the sea to look at squids, or for that matter cuttlefishes or octopuses, but were probably writing in landlocked libraries, copying or summarizing Aristotle's texts. So that confusion does become pretty much a quality of squid, or even squishy natural history for the next many years, let's say the next 1,000 or so years.
And as you later discuss in the book, I mean, we still have, we'll encounter cases where something we're calling a squid is actually not technically a squid, right?
Do you mean the cuttlefish?
Wasn't there, when you start talking about the vampire squid?
Oh, yes, the vampire squid, yes, of course. Right, technically that is not a squid. It's actually more of an octopod, because it doesn't really have the same layout of arms and tentacles that squids do. So yes, it you're right. That's one of the strangest creatures, and also a creature with one of the most delightful names, the vampire squid from hell. yes, but it almost certainly is, or let's say at least possibly, it's not actually a squid, but a sepia.
Yeah, I love the illustrations we see of this particular cephalopod in the book. One of them I was really taken with. I hadn't seen this particular illustration before, but the artist almost, it seemed like they were trying to make the squid appear like a skull. Am I alone in interpreting it this way?
Sure. Yes, I think that's certainly appropriate. That's I believe, Carl Chun's illustration. I have it right here. It does look like a skull because it's black, and it's in this particular illustration, it's upside down, so it has this sort of ghoulish mouth that seems to be in sort of a hideous grin underneath two eyes, and then there's a nose socket. Right, that's sort of a fanciful rendition of a vampire squid.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health-Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health-Aid Kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Now, going back to the to ancient writings here, Pliny the Elder, of course, his accounts inevitably come up when anytime we're discussing Western understandings of the natural world. And I was really taken by a bit from Pliny that you discuss in the book. Can you explain the proposed connection between the, quote, lavish nature of liquid and large marine animal sizes?
Well, Pliny, very much the an heir of Aristotle, describing the world as he thought, and describing the world very much as a Roman. So when he looked out onto bodies of water, lakes, rivers, and the sea, he saw that there was this large form that was basically being fed continually by rainfall and other forms of precipitation. So that's the nourishment that he sees taking place. And then he draws a basic analogy between two different realms of the world. On the one hand, there's the terrestrial realm populated by humans and land animals, and then the aqueous world. And he says every form of life that exists on land must also have its counterpart in the sea, in the aqueous realm. But because the aqueous realm is more obviously nourished by precipitation, and is by precipitation, which is like the aqueous realm, then land is like precipitation. That means then that the animals are nourished themselves more than land animals are. So they grow to greater sizes, even monstrous sizes. And because water is more fluid, they also are liable to take more varied shapes and even diverge into completely different animals that do not exist on land. So that analogy is central to Pliny's kind of thinking about natural history. And it's also a clear indication that he's thinking speculatively, since, of course, he didn't have a bathysphere and couldn't see below the surface of the dark sea. But it's also really on the basis of that later accounts of sea monsters claim to have some basis in natural history and fact.
I also love a bit from Pliny that you share, because this is one of those quotes that I guess when you're looking at things Pliny shared, I guess sometimes, you know, second or third hand about things in the world, sometimes they may feel a bit detached from the actual reality. But this is one of those quotes that I feel like just speaks across the ages and matches up with like my experience of seeing octopi in the wild or any cephalopods in an aquarium. And that is, quote, that squids are virtually incomprehensible to those who have never seen one, because they continually shift their appearance by moving their arms and changing colors. I don't know about you, but I thought that really had a real ring of solid truth to it.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned at the very beginning, one of my interests in squids is just that incomprehensibility. How can there be such an animal? The basic word cephalopod, the official term for this whole group of animals, really means a head of feet, right? Mm-hmm. Cephalo and then pod for feet. That makes no sense. And that name encapsulates the oddness and strangeness, the alien quality of these creatures, and they really do challenge our basic sense of what an animal should be like or act like, because indeed they do change shape continually, they change colors continually, and they in many ways they should not exist. There were even questions at various times in history about whether they should be categorized as animals or instead as plants. And so they've always been a real mystery and a real challenge to our ability to create taxonomies and explanations and based on categories of animals and their relations to one another, because there's always the troubling question of how do we set this head of feet in relation to ourselves? And who's backwards? Are we built backwards or are they?
Now, you mentioned the mysterious, and of course, you spend a lot of time in the book discussing mythologies and folklore concerning various cephalopods, and of course, you get into the giant squid quite a bit as well. Getting more into the scientific realm here, can you tell us what role Japetus Steenstra played in bridging squid myth and squid science of the 19th century?
Yes, that's a great question for lots of reasons. Stage up is really the turning point from the tradition of let's say squid lore based on legends and uncertainty and the terminological vagueness that we were talking about to modern classifications that made possible scientific studies about squids and cephalopods. So for a number of years, especially in the North Atlantic area, there had been, of course, there were the legends of the kraken, the big monsters that swallowed up ships, or that people would mistake as islands and land on and perform religious rituals and then be swallowed up and dragged down to the sea. And those legends were intermixed with a number of beachings of giant squids, the Architeuthis ducks, and other sightings of squids. And they were recorded as historical events, really starting in, let's say, the 16th century by Guillaume Rondelet, who described strange creatures that he referred to as monkfish or Episcopal fish. And he illustrated his accounts with drawings of creatures that had fins instead of feet and hands, but were wearing a monk's habit or a cardinal's mitre. And that those sorts of accounts really verge on myths and fabulous accounts. But there was still an effort to provide some kind of empirical credence to the existence of these unbelievable monsters. So as a number of sightings and beachings occurred, by the middle of the 19th century, Steenstrup came along, and fortuitously, someone gave him a beak from one of the giant squids that had beached. He delivered a lecture in 1854 where he went through all the different accounts of sea monsters by Rondelet and others. And he performed a kind of literary analysis of all the descriptions, which had probably been gathered by Rondelet and others from fishermen's accounts who tried to describe these bizarre creatures they had seen. Steenstrup then concluded that all these accounts referred to one very real creature. And so after a lengthy series of exegeses of these various accounts, he quite dramatically presented to his audience this beak he had been given, a very imposing beak. A squid's beak is sort of like a hawk's beak or a parrot's beak, so it's really sharp and curved and meant to tear flesh. So this is a good-sized beak, and he, with that sort of dramatic flourish of showing his audience this beak, he was really to change the accounts of seafarers and let's say the legends of monsters into a verifiable animal that could be given a scientific name. And he's the one who then gave it the name Architeuthis ducks. And with that name, he basically cleared up the ambiguity that existed since Aristotle, and he allowed for a focused and disciplined study of squids based on a real taxonomy, and a taxonomy that lays out different genera of squids, different species of squids, and is able to map their locations around the world. So in short, Staines really marks the transition from the world of myth and uncertainty and ambiguity to the world of modern empirical study.
Now, speaking of modern study, one of the big topics that comes up in all of this, and you discuss in the book, of course, is our attempts to understand cephalopod intelligence. And you bring up some of our responses to cephalopod intelligence, and even the idea that they could be, quote, the primates of the sea. What are the challenges and limits in play when it comes to understanding the mind of the squid?
Well, the challenges at play are great, even though there is such a thing as scientific study of squids, and the science on squids is growing. The taxonomy of squids is expanding exponentially as more and more species and genera are being discovered continually. But on the other hand, exactly what these creatures are still remains teasing, because they're these strange creatures whose heads consist of feet. But they also have sizable brains, and they show a real intelligence. The marine biologist Jennifer Mather has pointed out, I think most valuably, that squids exist, and I'm quoting her here, worlds away from us. And even though, she says, even though their brains may not have quite the same structure as ours, yet they can still be seen to work in analogous ways to our brains, and therefore their intelligence can be seen to be somewhat analogous, albeit bizarre. It's worth noting that squid brains regulate movement through visual cues. That makes their perception and their movement, their response to that perception, almost simultaneous. In fact, so simultaneous as to be virtually the same event. Whereas, let's say, in humans, most land creatures, we perceive something and it might take a second or two to respond. Squids perceive and respond instantaneously. Scientists have focused particularly on what they call the giant axon, a very large nerve fiber that radiates throughout the wall of the mantle, the long tubular part of the squid. This nerve is about a millimeter in diameter, and really the largest nerve of any animal in the world. And it's the size of this nerve that enables the squid to transmit its perceptions from its eyes and other receptors around its body instantaneously into its musculature to move. So that they can propel themselves by shooting out streams of water within milliseconds of perceiving something that they want to attack, and their intelligence can and should be described as one of movement on the one hand and predation on the other hand, or really that's almost the same as well, because they really are predators, and they are hypersensitive to their environment. They have a number of organs and mechanisms for perception, not just their eyes, but along their entire bodies that enable them to perceive well beyond our five senses. They don't have hearing, almost certainly, but they are able to perceive motion, and motion at a very, very fine degree. And they also then can famously change colors, flash colors brilliantly, illuminate themselves through chromatophores, which are essentially sacks of pigments that cover their entire body and that can be contracted and opened at will to change the color of the skin. And as these sacs open and shut, expand and contract, they reveal some iridophores underneath. And the iridophores reflect light back as a kind of iridescence. But it's a different kind of light. It's more of a polarized light, which we humans aren't really geared to perceive, though we can see a kind of sheen the way you would see on a soap bubble. And these changes, these chromatophores, are really controlled, again, by the squid's eyes. So movement, color changes are all instantaneous and very much part of squid intelligence, governed by astonishing powers of perception, very dominant and impressive nervous system, and a brain. So to think of them as primates of the sea, they are, again, predators, and they pretty much live not at the top of the food chain because, of course, they're eaten by many other creatures, but their intelligence and their athleticism certainly makes them formidable. So it definitely puts them at the top of many people's hierarchy.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health-Aid Kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned here that really blew me away, you discuss Hanlon and Messenger's research into quote-unquote squid talk and touch on their idea that the squid in particular may engage in not only play, but dishonesty in communication. What are we to make of this?
Right. That's a delightful discovery by these scientists. First of all, Jennifer Mather, again, has studied what she refers to as squiddish, the language of squids. She's categorized it through studying various postures and light flashes that squids make, so that she's able to come up with something approaching a lexicon. And for the most part, scientists and others look at this lexicon as simply being informational, the way we usually think of animal communication being informational. Birds squawk and chirp, perhaps to say good morning, or you and I are boyfriend and girlfriend, or there's a predator close by, or something like that. And if we start to think, as Roger Hanlon and John Messenger suggest, that perhaps squids are not simply communicating information, but they're creating misinformation, disinformation, that suggests that there's something else going on, a higher level of communication. And it suggests that there might even be, a performative quality to squiddish, to squid communication, which is to say it's not literal, it's not simply informational, but it's something else. And that dishonesty plays a big role in, literary allusions. So the very much of literature does not simply consist of information relayed about something. It's not simply the empirical descriptions of Aristotle, but it's suggestive. It's allusive. It relies on puns, and it can rely on jokes. That suggestion that squids are not simply, unimaginative animals who are merely saying food here, predator there, but perhaps have the capacity for joking or imagination. But then, since squids are undeniably major predators and even cannibals, we have to ask what are their jokes, or what are they imagining? Are they making jokes about us, which is discomforting, or are they making jokes with a punchline, "I will eat you"? Or if their jokes are not found funny by other squids, will they be eaten? That's plenty of room for jokes of our own, and also worry.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, a lot of that, I guess, we're talking about information bicephalopods, four cephalopods. But coming back to the topic of what cephalopods can do for us, right. So something that certainly drives a lot of the research, as you point out. What are the brightest possibilities here? And what are the arguments for eating cephalopods, even if they might be primates of the sea? Because I know that I know people who, like, for instance, are pescatarians, but don't eat cephalopods or make a distinct choice not to eat them based on some of the intelligence research out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the argument for eating cephalopods is simply their enormous numbers. They swarm throughout virtually all oceans and seas except for the Black Sea and high quantities they are highly or the fisheries geared around squids are very successful in catching large quantities of them. And that's important in this time of industrial fishing when many species of aquatic life are being simply wiped out through the drag netting and other forms of industrial fishing. So that it really has become a mass produced kind of food which have depleted virtually everything. Squid seem to be impervious to that, or at least so far. That's really the argument. I'm going to hold off on what it means to eat something of intelligence for just a second, because there are other possibilities for ways humans have sought to use to exploit squid. One, of course, is their the giant axon, so that scientists have begun to harvest squid just for that nerve, in the hopes of using them to rejuvenate humans who have become paralyzed, who have lost neurological functions, and that's a big hope for the pharmaceutical industry. And there are even suggestions that because of the squid's capacity to change colors, that maybe some genius will find a way of transferring that into use by the military-industrial complex to allow, let's say, camouflage in the battlefield, so that just as in Philip K. Dick's novel *Scanner Darkly*, where the policemen wear these scanner suits that change their physical configuration completely, so let's say warriors could change themselves completely so that nobody could see them. So that sounds pretty far-fetched, but it's perhaps on at least the table. As for eating them, or let's say exploiting them in any sense, for the military or for medical uses, I think those arguments really rest on viewing them as resources, overlooking that intelligence, or at best as, or at least disqualifying squid intelligence as being less than human intelligence. It's long been our tendency to say whatever is alien to us, whatever is different from me, it cannot be as good as I am. It can't even be real because it's not human. It's not really intelligence. I might even mention that when I submitted my book to the press, one of the editors took real issue with my references to squid humor. She said, that's impossible. There's no such thing as humor in the animal world. It has never been documented. Well, I don't know. I disagree. As I said, I spent plenty of time around horses, and I know that they can be real jokesters. And I know dogs can be jokesters, and fox hunters around the world will tell you about foxes playing real tricks. And so there is such thing as humor, but it's hard to fathom what cephalopod humor or cephalopod intelligence would be. But I think it's also important to recognize, I'll just challenge your fish-eating friends further and say, well, certainly all kinds of fish, all creatures have intelligence. And we have to ask ourselves if it's just different from ours, or if it really and truly is lesser than ours, which would justify us eating a lesser being. I don't know.
Now, you, of course, get into cephalopod evolution, taking us back 500 to 600 million years. But then something special seems to have occurred during the struggle with fish and marine reptiles. Can you describe what we think happened here?
Well, of course, it's all highly speculative. Mm-hmm. But around 450 million years ago, I believe this is what you're referring to, always been called as the Devonian extinction, when pretty much almost all life disappeared. And slowly animals began to reappear in various parts of the world, but decidedly not in the deepest oceans because oxygen levels there are low. But cephalopods seem to do okay. They moved offshore. Squids in particular moved into the deeper water so that look back to Aristotle's two accounts of the inshore and the offshore squids. The offshore squids grew bigger because squids generally lost their shells, their molluscan shells. They were able to move faster, and they didn't have the bones that fishes had, so that they were able to prey upon the fish that previously preyed upon them, because boneless squids were able to move much faster and react more quickly than bony fishes could. So that was one of the, theoretically, one of the key steps in the development of ur squids to somewhat modern squids that we see fairly recently, relatively speaking.
Now, you've already alluded to changes going on in the oceans today. Is there a cephalopod explosion happening in the world today? Are we seeing changes in cephalopod populations?
Well, it certainly seems so in many ways. Popular presses around the world have referred to squid blooms or squid invasions, where large populations of cephalopods show up in a particular area. And it seems that that could be happening because of climate change, so that the currents are shifting. That's one explanation for why Humboldt squids have shown up in large numbers in certain years around Monterey Bay, California, and have in such large numbers that they have washed ashore by the millions. Causing, of course, serious hygienic issues. And it's also possible because of which to say that the explosion of squids is also possible because of the depletion of other fish, of fish that might be eating squids or competing with squids for other food. Maybe whales have been depopulated enough to allow for explosions of squid. But it's also possible that people are starting to pay more attention to squids. When there are putative squid blooms somewhere, then fishing fleets will swarm to a particular area and fish that area heavily. And since squids have a fairly short life, a very short life, generally about a year, they can disappear and then reappear again later on. And as they move through the current, they can appear in a different place and again in large numbers. I might just mention squid breed in such large numbers that scientists have referred to them as the protein pump of the sea, so that as they breed in one part of the sea, then move to another part of the sea, die and decompose, they provide nutrients for other fish, other aquatic life forms, so that they've moved around in that way as well. At any rate, it seems that squids are highly adaptable. As climate change happens, squids, more than bony fish and other aquatic creatures, are very willing to change. They're very willing to move into areas that had previously been thought to be incompatible with squids. Or cephalopods, or really any form of life. And I think that the bottom line there is we see that almost certainly squids will endure.
Now, obviously, I love the section in the book on folkloric squids and how interconnected the folklore is with our just basic understanding of the various species. And I think our listeners will particularly enjoy this section of the book as well. And I can't possibly ask you about all of it, but one example I wanted to bring up was the idea you share of the Norse sea reek, and the idea that the sea reek might be linked to ammonia in the giant squid body. Can you describe this?
That's a slight connection that I hope I'm not making too much of. But it is the case that the giant squid, Architeuthis dux, made famous by Stainsrope and others, possesses ammonia chloride in its flesh. And the reason for that is that these are animals that live very deep in the ocean, and the ammonia chloride provides buoyancy so that they don't float to the surface where they wouldn't want to be because they'd be eaten by birds or whatever, and also prevents them from sinking down to the bottom. Now, all squids have ammonia chloride, really just a giant squid and a few other species and genera. But in much of the folklore of squids, and folklore extending up into novels of the modern era, the reek of ammonia is very much an aspect of an encounter with a kraken or a half goofa or one of these monsters of the seas that would supposedly wrap their arms around an entire ship and drag it to the bottom of the ocean. So I think the sea reek is a possible literal account of this feared mythic and yet real monsters that everyone dreaded and always left kind of telltale odor in its wake.
Yeah, throughout this section, I was just, you know, trying to, you know, to put myself in the mindset, possible mindset of say, you know, a Norse seaman, you know, witnessing this, smelling these creatures, you know, encountering, you know, firsthand and then secondhand knowledge of them. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, and frightening.
Yes,
of course. I mean, the sea is frightening enough, since we all know that. Humans aren't meant to be in the sea in a natural sense. We tend to sink. And we also know that way down deep, there are monsters like the vampire squid from hell and giant squids who will attack our ships.
Yeah, and I love how this is a recurring theme in the book, talking about our relationship with the sea, our relationship then with squid and the idea of the squid. And of course, that leads us to the squid gods. So when I say squid gods, I know many listeners are probably thinking of a certain fictional deity that we'll mention in a moment here. But there is a squid deity in Polynesian traditions, right?
Well, I hesitate to speak authoritatively about another culture. But Polynesian culture is very close to the ocean. And from what I was able to understand from my own very amateurish investigation, is that there are prayers to Kanaloa, who is described as god of the squid. It does not seem that god is actually a squid, but is perhaps represented by a squid, since it would be inappropriate to say the god's name directly, literally. But it is the case that also that, as in many cultures, there are certain beings that serve as family guardians, which can ward off threats and bring good fortune to a particular family. These, of course, these guardians would be revered, and among those would be the squid. And in that regard, one of my happiest discoveries when I was researching for the book was the modern New Zealand poet Darren Kamali, who invokes ancient Polynesian traditions in his poetry. He calls upon guardian squids to rejuvenate his culture that has been subsumed by the Western views, by commercial exploitation of non-human life. And so his songs about squids, about a squid becoming a man whose tentacles then become dreadlocks, who then chants these rejuvenating songs. They become chants calling up this ancient life, this ancient familiarity and let's say companionship or guardianship among animals, or let's just put it this way, an ancient community among humans and other creatures that perhaps can rectify some of the ills caused by Western exploitation and Western views that squid intelligence cannot be compared to human intelligence, that it has to be less than intelligence to enable us to exploit them just for their nerve fibers or for their flesh.
Wow. I feel like that would almost be a fitting end to the interview. right there. But I have to, of course, ask you about the squid in literature, and particularly in some of the weird fiction of the 20th and the 21st century. And again, there's a lot in the book. I'm not going to ask you about everything. I encourage our listeners to pick up a copy and dive in themselves. But one of the big ones you, of course, discuss is Jules Verne's treatment of the giant squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. How essential is this novel to pop culture visions of the giant squid?
Oh, well, it's enormously important. In many ways, Verne does just the reverse of what Steinstrup did. So that in the narrative, the main character, Professor Aronnax, who is a natural historian, gives an account of the giant squids that he sees from inside the submarine that's led by the evil Captain Nemo. And he gives Aronnax's descriptions very accurate, empirical, dispassionate description. But then almost immediately that scene turns into a very exciting, dramatic account where the squids are attacking the Nautilus, and they become the repellent embodiments of the old myths, and who try to pull Aronnax's companion, the harpoonist Ned Land, from the ship until Captain Nemo hacks off the tentacle of the squid. And so Ned Land is almost chopped in two by the beak, the giant beak of the monster squid. So really what Verne is able to accomplish there is making something that seems scientific into a rejuvenation of the old myths of the Kraken, of the sea monsters. So we end up with a decidedly modern, empirical kind of dread, and a modern kind of anxiety, so that we can name what these creatures are and still feel yikes, if I venture out into the sea, they'll definitely grab hold of me and chop me in half with their giant beak. So that has really laid the groundwork, as you yourself said, for much of the later kinds of stories that describe space aliens coming to the world and destroying the world. And of course, those aliens all are squids.
Yeah, that you you of course bring up H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu and the Call of Cthulhu, which I think most of our listeners are probably familiar with. But then you also touched on a work by William Hope Hodgson, The Boats of Glen Carrig. And I've read Hodgson's The Nightland, but I wasn't familiar with this one. Can you tell us a little about it and its role in squid-related weird fiction?
First of all, I really have to give a shout out to my great friend Tim Murphy, who is not only a lover of squids, in fact, almost as much as I am, but also an expert on Hodgson's book and weird fiction generally. And he's just finishing a book on Hodgson. And in short, the story of the Boats of Glen Carrig come from the voice of John Winterstraw, who's the narrator, who's basically telling a kind of sailor's story of having once encountered strange monsters at sea. Basically, what happens in his sailor's story is that his ship, the Glen Carrig, gets caught in a big field of seaweed, let's say probably something like the Sargasso Sea. And it's worth noting parenthetically that Hodgson did spend quite a bit of time in the Merchant Marine. So he was familiar with ships. He was familiar with ship lore. and with these kinds of tales that sailors tell one another. But he also was interested in that category of fiction that's called weird fiction. So while the Glencairn is caught in this Sargasso Sea or just a field of seaweed, the sailors begin to fret because they encounter other ships that have been obviously trapped there so long, they've just become skeleton ships, until finally they drift towards what seems to be an island. And they try to set up a residence on the island. And then Winterstraw notices a few times, he looks over the side of a boat. And the title of the novel comes from the fact that the sailors escaped from the ship, from the Glencairn, in the ship's boats, which they rowed towards the island. So while he's in one of these boats, Winterstraw looks over the side, and he sees a white, human-like face staring back up at him. That, of course, scares the bejesus out of him. And then once they get on the island, the sailors begin to encounter other beings. There seem to be encampments of squid-like characters. It seems that perhaps these squid monsters are traveling underneath the island in subterranean caverns and showing up on land and attacking the fortified residence of the sailors. And the attacks happen nightly over a span of time, even to the point that the sailors become exhausted, and they set up lookouts hoping to ward off more attacks. Winterstraw at numerous points looks out to sea, and he can see the squid monsters swarming into the island in what he describes as disciplined formations. So it's as though it's a squid army coming to attack the marooned sailors. And the disturbing quality there, and the really intriguing quality, and I think this is what Hodgson, what makes Hodgson such an interesting writer and much of his work, and is that he really probes the question of alien intelligence. What a lot of what you and I have been talking about in the past few minutes. In this regard, we could even think back perhaps to the squid jokes that might not be funny to us, because these disciplined military formations of squids would seem to demonstrate a high intelligence, a very sophisticated intelligence, and an intelligence that's directed at us humans in a way that is about as discomforting as I think is possible. And that is thinking of us humans as the resources for a squid economy. So the question would be, what use would humans be to a squid civilization? How can humans be exploited by squid intelligence? And that really goes against everything that we want to say about ourselves in relation to our fellow creatures, and about our view of ourselves as the only dominant intelligent force on the planet. And I think it's as my friend Tim Murphy suggests throughout his discussion of weird fiction, since weird fiction is pretty far removed from, let's say, mainstream fiction, that's the kind of question that weird fiction can ask that other forms of of literary inquiry or other forms of scientific or historical inquiry really cannot venture into. And that's, I think, the value of weird fiction and the value of learning how to read the myths and legends of ancient times and the theological accounts of other cultures in a less skeptical way, perhaps in a more open-minded sense of seeing that maybe we're not the only intelligence, and maybe there are other ways of engaging intelligently with the world.
Excellent. Well, finally, one last question here. After reading the book, I have a couple of guesses about what your answer might be, but do you have a favorite squid species?
Oh, absolutely. I don't even have to hesitate. My favorite squid is a little apart from the traditional favorite squid. The favorite squid, I think, generally is the giant squid because of all the lore that's grown up around it over the millennia. But I really became fascinated by the Humboldt squid, the Pithecus gigas, right, which is about 5 feet long. It's also referred to as the Red Devil because it has plenty of lore of its own, so that we hear over and over again that sailors fall from the boats, their fishing boats, and they're immediately devoured by swarms of Humboldt squids who chomp them to pieces. There are videos on YouTube of underwater cameramen being attacked by one of these 5 foot long squids coming after him and ripping his oxygen hose and so on. And of course, these are the squids that defy explanation in their ability to pass through areas of the ocean where there is no oxygen, and where they're not supposed to be able to go, and yet they do. And they're also hunted in large numbers for their giant axons and their flesh and their fears. And I think because of their adaptability, their voraciousness, I'll just even add this one detail. There's one weirdly delightful video of some scientists putting a camera on a Humboldt squid to see how it interacts with other Humboldt squids or what it does way down in the ocean depth. But the video only lasts a few seconds because you can tell that the squid is descending and then immediately another squid approaches and eats it.
Oh, wow.
So the screen just goes blank. So that aggression, even to cannibalism of one's schoolmates, of maybe one even one's family, if that's conceivable, all that is alien and gets right to the heart of why I wanted to write the book.
Excellent. Well, again, for everyone out there, the book is Squid. It is part of Reaction's Animal series. It's available in physical and digital formats. And now that I know that you also have one on the Fox, I'm going to have to pick that up as well. I'm instantly thinking of all the various folklore surrounding the Fox and its secretive nature.
Oh, great. Great. I just put a plug out. Let me say that there are 100 different animals covered in Reaction's series. And really, all those books have a great deal to offer. All the different authors have their own approaches to particular animals. Not everyone is trained in literature as I am. There are scientists, sociologists, historians, journalists, you name it. Many people have been intrigued by how to talk about an animal and what it means to try to understand the relevance of one animal to human life and culture.
Excellent. Well, thanks for being on the show, Martin.
Sure, Rob. Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks again to Martin Wallen for taking time out of his day to chat with me. Again, the book is Squid from 2021, part of the Reaction Animal series, which also includes Wallen's book on the fox. Wallen's other works include Whose Dog Are You? The Technology of Dog Breeds and the Aesthetics of Modern Human-Canine Relations, and City of Health, Fields of Disease, Revolutions in the Poetry, Medicine, and Philosophy of Romanticism. As always, if you want to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed, which you'll get wherever you find your podcast. Core science and culture episodes publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Listener mail on Mondays, short form artifact or monster fact on Wednesdays, and on Friday, we set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. If you'd like to reach out to me, or Joe, or any of us here at the show, simply drop us an email at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, berry lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.